Hey, moneymakers, welcome back to another live edition of Taking Stock. It is our first live show of the year. I sure hope that you guys enjoyed our show last week, which was our Taking Stock year in review with our highlights from 2023 and our look forward to 2024. I'm Kalila Reynolds. It's my pleasure to be back in the studio with you for another exciting show. Make sure you hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, and leave your comments in the chat, because backstage right now, we have opposition leader Mark Golding, who is ready and rearing to join us in just a few. So what questions do you have for the opposition leader? Drop them in the chat so that we can, you know, take your questions later on in the show. So are you ready to get this money? Make sure that you, like I said, hit the like button, and come on. As we always say, let's get this money.
Healthcare, crime, inflation, and education. These are some of the major issues Jamaicans are concerned about. We'll sit down with the leader of the opposition, Mark Golding, to discuss the PNP's plans to tackle these pressing issues. And the analysts weigh in on the latest market developments. Honeybun's year-end results are out. How did they perform? We'll discuss. But first, here's What's Hot, brought to you by JMMB Group, your best interest at heart. Investment firm Blumaho Capital has purchased an almost 2% stake in KLE Group. According to Blumaho's CEO David Mullings, the deal will give its property fund investors exposure to KLE's real estate portfolio. KLE is currently developing an 8-acre luxury villa complex in Arakabesa, St. Mary. Additionally, Mulling said he believes he can help KLE expand the Usain Bolt tracks and records chain into the United States. JN Bank is urging its customers to remain vigilant after scammers robbed multiple customers over the weekend. According to JN, 13 customers from the bank's Morant Bay branch reported unauthorized transactions from their accounts via ATMs and point-of-sale terminals. JN said customers were defrauded through a scam called card skimming. Scammers created duplicates of the customers' debit cards using the card data. The bank said preliminary findings suggest no JN ATMs or POS machines were used in the fraud. They urged customers to pay attention to the transaction notifications and flag any suspicious activity. Bitcoin prices jumped to almost $47,000 on Wednesday, following the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission approving 11 applications for Bitcoin exchange-traded funds, ETFs. An ETF gives investors an easy way to invest in assets or a group of assets without directly buying the assets themselves. The SEC last Wednesday approved the first U.S.-listed ETFs to track a Bitcoin, in what many consider a turning point for the crypto industry. The ETFs began trading on Thursday and saw almost $5 billion worth of shares trading. According to the World Bank, the global economy is projected to experience its worst half-decade of growth in 30 years. Global growth is projected to slow down for the third consecutive year in 2024, dropping to 2.4% from 2.6% in 2023. The bank noted that the continued Russian invasion of Ukraine and the growing conflict in the Middle East could have significant implications for energy prices. Increased energy prices will in turn impact inflation and global economic growth. The World Bank said developing economies are expected to bear the brunt of the impact as sluggish global trade and tight financial conditions exert significant pressure on their growth.
What's Hot was brought to you by JMMB Group, your best interest at heart.
If you're about to start 2024 broke, listen carefully. You need a plan. Your debt may seem insurmountable and your income too small, but you can do it, just like Anita.
I had quite a number of debt from that master's program, and Kalila came to my organization. We had a session where she introduced us to how to budget, how to manage our money, and also how to invest. And through the tools that she gave us on that day, the tools and the templates that she provided me, I was able to set up my budget, organize my life, all my income streams, what my credit card debts are like, and how to manage that. And I was able to get out of debt by March the following year. I took approximately 5 months, and this was something I was struggling with for maybe about a year. And with Kalila's help through the Money Mission, I was able to get through that.
We're gonna plan out the whole of 2024. I promise you that if you stick to the plan, your life will be dramatically better at the end of 2024. Let's get this money.
This segment of Taking Stock is brought to you by Bulwark Insurance Agency. Insurance made easy.
Welcome back. Let me know in the chat where you're joining us from this evening. I see a couple of people on. Chris is checking in from Panama City. We got Shellyanne, who says she can finally say she's checking in from Jamaica with a beef patty. So welcome home, Shellyanne. We got Jermaine all the way in China. Nana sends from far, far away. Dalton there in Discovery Bay. Let me know where you are joining us from this evening, what part of the country and what part of the world. And also, as you saw in that promotion just now, the Build Your Budget live in-person workshop has been moved to January 27, because a lot of you were reaching out to me saying, Kalila, Brooke, after Christmas, when no money, I have to wait on my payday, on January payday. So I said, okay, fine, I'll move it to the 27th of January, and you let me know if you're still coming. So the information is there. But right now, it is time to check in with none other than the leader of the opposition and the People's National Party, Mr. Mark Golding. Welcome, Mark.
Greetings. Hi there. Hi, Kalila.
It's really good to have you on. This interview has been a couple months in the making, but we're glad that we're able to make it work now.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm going to start with a somewhat general question, right? How would you describe the state of the Jamaican economy right now?
The Jamaican economy has achieved a certain maturity in terms of our macro fiscal situation. We have, over the last decade, through the efforts of successive governments, been able to bring our public debt substantially under control and reduce it to much closer to what is regarded internationally as a sustainable level relative to the size of the economy, GDP. So that has been a very important achievement. And, you know, it was achieved through significant discipline, fiscal discipline over the decade. And the rules that have been written into our law to ensure that governments adhere to prudent fiscal policies, which are generally referred to as the fiscal rules, have borne fruit in the sense of ensuring that governments stay on track to achieve a more sustainable debt level, which is very important because that enables more resources to be available to do other things, very important things like looking after the infrastructure of the country, looking after important services such as health services, education, etc. So from a macro fiscal point of view, things are, I would say, you know, fairly stable, and there's not much to be worried about in that regard. However, in terms of how people feel about living here and the experience they have living in Jamaica, it's a different picture. For those who are relatively privileged and well off, life is comfortable, no doubt. But for a lot of Jamaicans, it's a struggle. It's a struggle because the hospitals are really not looking after persons who come there in a way which allows them to feel that they are treated with dignity. When they need a hospital bed, they often have to wait a very long time. They often have to wait on a bench, sometimes for days, or lying on the floor in a wheelchair when they should be admitted and in a bed. In terms of the education system, we have serious problems which have been studied and documented. We have the problem of, you know, primary school children, a large percentage of them, over 30%, leaving primary school unable to read and write and do basic arithmetic. And that, of course, results in those children typically having very challenging years through secondary school, poor outcomes, sometimes they leave with no subjects, and that feeds into the disaffection and the stymied opportunities for those young people. And that, of course, feeds into the crime and violence problem, which remains a very serious problem in the country. It's a huge drain on our economic growth and our wealth creation, and it also saps hope and makes living in Jamaica a fearful experience for many. So although the economy on the face of it, and from a credit rating agency's perspective, is robust in the sense that our reserves are strong, we've been running a tidy ship from a budgetary perspective for a year, etc., that is not really reflecting in the hopes and dreams, the aspirations of our people being realized. And I think that's a great developmental challenge that Jamaica faces now, is how do we translate the statistical gains, the accounting gains, the public financial gains that have been realized, how do we translate that into really improving the quality of life of the majority of our people? And making a less unequal society, a society which is more cohesive from a social perspective, where all Jamaicans feel part of it. For many Jamaicans, their aspirations are to leave Jamaica and to try and make a living, a better life for themselves and their families abroad. Mm-hmm. And that is, obviously not an ideal situation for a country that is a proud nation, a country which has delivered to the world such popular culture, and has this brand which we're all proud of, through our music, our creative industries, our sports prowess, etc. But we still haven't got it right.
So what would you do differently from the current administration to improve the economy and to improve some of these issues that you mentioned just now? We can't talk about all of them just yet because you mentioned a lot, crime, education, healthcare, but specifically on the economy, what would you and your party do differently?
Well, I think it is important to continue the trajectory of reducing the public debt and achieving debt sustainability. It's written into our law, and it is something which we put a lot of sacrifice as a nation into getting to where we are. When we entered into the IMF program in 2013, our debt to GDP ratio was 147%. And that was way out of whack. That had accumulated rapidly in the previous years and needed to be addressed for the long-term future of the country. As I've said, great strides have been made bringing that down somewhere in the 80-odd% region now. And that is a very good thing. And we are committing to taking it to 60%, which is the statutory target that's built into the fiscal rules.
Go ahead.
But having said that, there is much more fiscal space now for policy options. So we are very interested in focusing on the problems of the primary school system and that major gap that I identified earlier as to, such a large percentage of our school children not getting the basics by the time they leave primary school. That has to be fixed. And that means more focus on the causes of the poor performance in primary schools, ensuring that teachers are well paid, that the teacher training system is adequate for the needs of the school system, and that the schools themselves are, especially the ones that are underperforming, are given the necessary attention to bring them up to scratch. That's a major plank for us. The training system in the country also, I think, is underperforming. For many years under the current administration, HART, which is a state trading agency, didn't actually have a functional board. So students who went through HART programs couldn't have their certificates signed, which meant that it was a very frustrating process for them. We need to look at our training system and I think have much more private sector input into that, because there are a number of companies in Jamaica that run excellent training programs internally. They call themselves, universities often, but they're training for the jobs that they have and that are coming downstream through the investments that they're making. And I think we need to really incentivize those companies that are capable of expanding their training, to do so and, you know, work in tandem with HART and the state training apparatus so that we're developing skills in our people that can service high value added investment and build our national productivity, which is the ultimate way that we can create greater wealth and grow our economy. So that's another area of focus for me. In terms of tertiary education,
the national productivity, absolutely important. Yeah. But I think, Mr. Golding, probably issue number one on the economic front for Jamaicans right now is inflation, the cost of living. In the past year, things have gotten dramatically more expensive. And we don't know how to, a lot of people just don't know how to cope with the dramatic increase in the cost of living. So how do we address this?
Yeah, well, I had said from 2021, when it was clear that the bottom had fallen out of the economy because of COVID, that the government should do more to cushion the crisis on the people. And I had suggested that the direct expenditure for making life more tolerable, more bearable, more survivable for people who need that kind of help be increased to 2% of GDP, which at that time was roughly $40 billion per year. The government didn't do that. They did something, but it was much less comprehensive than we thought was necessary. And with the inflation that has come after the pandemic, partly because of the geopolitical problems in the Ukraine and Russia now in the Middle East, but also because of the supply chain challenges that arose during the pandemic and which have continued to be problematic, the cost of living has really risen on people. And that, I think, requires a significant response. There can be a response through tax measures to relieve persons of some of the tax burden that they bear, especially lower income earners. And also there can be consideration for increasing the targeted relief that is given to persons who are on the edge of survival and, you know, through PATH and so on. So that is, of course, one has to carve up the pie, so to speak, in the best way that one can. And growing the economy which generates a bigger pie and creates greater resources for looking after people who need that kind of help. But in principle, we feel that the government needs to maximize at this time anyway, and when people are really ravaged by inflation and where, although the unemployment number is low officially, the reality is that when you poll, you know, polls show that unemployment remains a significant factor of concern for people. And that is because the way in which unemployment is measured in Jamaica includes persons in the employed category who are really marginally employed. They may be employed 1 hour a week, you know, so they're temporary, they're living hand to mouth. They may not be engaged in what you'd call formal jobs with benefits and so on. And they may be
Are people who are unemployed employable? Because on the one hand, we hear people saying we're looking for jobs, but on the other hand, you hear people from the productive sector, the manufacturers, the employers saying we can't find people with the requisite skills to employ, and we need to possibly look overseas.
I've heard that call, and I am reluctant to accept a need to employ labor from abroad, given that we have 720,000 Jamaicans over the age of 14 who are not in the labor force and who are outside of the labor force. Some of those are students, some of those are elderly persons, but several hundred thousand of them are in the adult cohort that ought to be employed. Now, how do you get those persons into the workforce? Again, it's a question of your training system. You need to have, for example, a much more aggressive approach towards certifying skilled persons who may not have had the benefit for one reason or another of getting certification, but who do have skills. And we have a lot of tradesmen in this country who fall into that category. And there are others who can be trained to learn the necessary skills to be part of the employed system, but it may take some investment to achieve that.
Training also takes some time. Training is not immediate. It will take months, possibly years, for those people to complete their training and be ready to do the jobs that are available that people that
depending on the nature of the jobs, it may be a question of months, it may be a question of more than months, maybe years. But you know, that there are also possibilities of learn on the job training as well. So persons can be employed while they're learning. But you know, one has to do what one can, and this is obviously a way in which you can achieve this is by trying to bring more of the persons who are outside the workforce into the workforce. And that is a critical thing for the country, because while you have such large numbers who are outside the workforce, you know, many of them are engaged in other types of activity too, which are undesirable, as we know, because we have a problem with a lot of illegal activity, which is itself creating problems for the society. So we really need to focus on trying to bring people into the workforce, into the legitimate system, so they can have proper jobs where they have proper benefits, not contract labor, where they're deprived of basic benefits and so on, but proper employment. And for that, skills training is absolutely vital.
Another big issue for Jamaicans is housing. So I'm taking my first question from the audience. Kim Loy Champagne wants to know, what are the plans for affordable housing?
It's a good question. We have seen a construction boom in the country, fueled by low real interest rates prior to the recent inflation problem, which has resulted in an adjustment to monetary policy. But for a period of a few years, there were very low interest rates in Jamaica relative to inflation. And there was also a tax break given to developers, essentially by lowering the cost of transfers in the government take tax applicable to transfers. But what happened, though, was that the developers focused in that segment of the market where there is, you know, better returns for them, which one, you know, understands that's what business people do. But the problem with it is that there is a very underserved segment, which is, you know, first-time home owners in fixed-income jobs, in the civil service, in the public service, or indeed, you know, in small business who have not yet really accumulated the kind of capital that would enable them to buy a home that is, you know, $30 million, $25 million. The lower income housing segment has been largely ignored and underserved for some time. And we need to get back into serving that so that people can start on the, you know, the home owning ladder. And over time, people can improve those homes and they can expand or they can move into a more expensive home as they become wealthier. But getting those homes built is important. The National Housing Trust has been denuded of resources for a long time, for 10 years now. The government has been, and that started with us when we were facing a crisis, a fiscal crisis, with a debt to GDP ratio of 147%, which we inherited when we came into office in 2012. And that, you know, as part of getting that under control, we had to run a very high primary surplus, 7.5% of GDP. And to square that circle, so to speak, we needed to take some resources out of the surplus that had built up in the National Housing Trust. And we passed a law to enable that to be done for 4 years. At the time, we were criticized heavily by the opposition. And in fact, they even had a civil society group close to them, took the matter to court, but lost. What then happened is when they came to power in 2016, they not just once, but twice passed laws extending that extraction of resources on an annual basis, even after the IMF agreement had come to an end. And it's still going on now. So the NHT is being stripped of $11.4 billion a year to help fund the budget. So when the government talks about no new taxes, bear in mind that one of the ways in which that is achieved is by stripping the housing trust of $11.4 billion a year. And that has really meant that the housing trust is not playing the role that it was envisaged as a catalyst for housing for the working class in the country. And that is a problem for us. So we are committed to ending that annual extraction of resources from the National Housing Trust.
Oh, and no, but how would you end that, given that that is one of the measures by which we fulfill our debt trajectory? And you've already said, been on record saying that we need to continue the trajectory that we're on.
Bear in mind, Kalila, that for the last few years, because of the reforms that were implemented in the tax system, starting in 2013 and continuing for the next 3 or 4 years, which have borne significant fruit. The government's tax revenue has overperformed each fiscal year by leaps and bounds, by approximately $100 billion a year. So they end up, at the end of the fiscal year, collecting revenue from the economy more than 100, or roughly $100 billion more than they had budgeted at the beginning of the year. And we feel that those surpluses are what you're really talking about in terms of how you spend those monies. And I think that given that there's a housing crisis, especially for low-income persons or for persons seeking to get into the housing market for the first time, you have to empower the housing trust with the resources it needs. And that really means stop taking that money out of the housing trust each year. That's one important way you can do it. As it stands now, the housing trust is having to, as it were, outsource lending to its contributors, to the private market. And the way it's doing that is that it's subsidizing the interest rate that the private lending market is providing to its contributors. And that's costing the housing trust going forward significant resources as well, which is going to further undermine its solvency. So these are, this is a problematic situation that the government has created in relation to the NHT over the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. When we implemented that for 4 years, we got an opinion from a top five audit firm that said that we could extract those resources without compromising the business plan of the NHT. But when it was extended after that period and has gone on and on year after year, it has had a very serious impact on the National Housing Trust.
So you're saying the government's current revenues have the ability to absorb that and just eliminate that extraction?
That's right. I believe that is the case. And it's a question, for example, of how you handle other things, how, you know, what kind of capital expenditure you're focusing on. The government has focused on, for example, a number of major public works projects, road projects and so on, that have used up significant resources. The Montego Bay Bypass project is being funded entirely out of the budget. There's no debt that's been taken on to build that, and so on. So there's a, it's all about prioritizing what you think needs to be done now to get the economy moving forward. We feel that capital expenditures are important, but they should not be at the expense of social expenditures that can help to make the economy more efficient, and that can help to make the country more productive, and can also create a better social environment in which investors feel that they should invest.
So let me just see if I'm understanding you correctly. Are you saying that roadworks such as the Montego Bay Bypass, major projects like that, the St. Thomas Highway, those are less important than, like you said, social expenditures? And is it that the policy would be that you would pause or slow down some of these major works that are currently being undertaken and use those funds for social expenditure, social expenses?
I believe that housing, low-income housing, is a very important need at this time. And the infrastructure for the settlements, informal settlements that we need to be formalized. People need to be given tenure, they need to have infrastructure so they can build homes and create wealth for themselves. I think those things are very important. I wouldn't discontinue or stop any project that is already underway. That would not make sense. But looking forward, I think that we need to focus much more on the things I've been talking about. And in terms of roadworks, we need to look, I think, spend more on road maintenance and ensuring that the roads that people drive on every day to get in and out of their homes are in a decent condition. They are in a deplorable situation now. So I am less interested in major road projects going forward and more interested in ensuring that the road network that we have is functionally usable without damaging people's cars, and so that, you know, you have less expense to the motorist and commuters in general from bad roads. But also focusing, as you asked me about housing, and I said, yes, housing needs some attention, and eliminating the extraction of resources from the housing trust is an important part of that.
So would the position be for the government to subsidize low-income housing? Because you're saying that, you know, if we're not taking the $11.5 billion from the NHT, but then also on the other hand, if we have, like, the private sector currently doesn't seem incentivized to build low-income housing because they're going after the luxury markets, it appears. So the burden falls on the government. Would you be prepared to subsidize affordable, quote unquote, affordable housing?
I think that there are ways that we can partner with private developers to encourage them to invest in low-income housing. It has been done before quite successfully. The whole of Portmore was built in that way, and many other schemes have been built across the country in that way. You know, the government has significant land resources that can be put in as equity to help developers reduce their costs. There may be some a way in which we can assist with infrastructure as well. So there may be some amount of public investment, yes, but that should get a return out of the proceeds of the project. The government, I think, has really dropped its hands, though. When I asked Minister Clark in Parliament, or when Minister Clark was asked in Parliament about why the government is not trying to do more to encourage developers to build low-income houses, he said, we've run ads twice, but we haven't found any takers. And I felt, that was, to me, a pathetic reply. You know, you need to get to bring them to the table and say, this is our strategy, and what will it take for us to collaborate and make it work? And you find solutions in that way. I'm sure it can be done because it's been done before very successfully.
When has it been done before successfully? Give me an example.
Well, look at the whole of Portmore, for example. That's tens of thousands of houses that were built in that way with, partnership with a private developer and the state using funds under the San Jose Accord at the time. You know, there are ways that these things can be done, and there are, other developments that have been built across the country in that way.
All right, let me take some more questions from the audience. Chantel Clark. I feel like Chantel already asked the question. Anyway, Chantel says, what are you hoping to do differently from the JLP to reduce crime and violence should your group be reelected to office? Crime is always the number one issue. So, and it connects to the economy as well, as you pointed out earlier. So what's the crime plan, Mr. Goldie?
I'm not saying there's any magic silver bullet to solving the problem of crime. It's been a long-term problem in the country. But the truth of the matter is that when the PNP was in government last, over those 4 years, we managed to reduce serious crime, in particular murders, significantly. And the average number of murders per year since we left office over the last 8 years of the JLP has been roughly 25% higher than the average under the 4 years that we were in government. Now, how did we achieve that? We didn't achieve that by taking away people's rights. We didn't try and achieve that by using states of emergency or other curfews excessively and so on. Rather, we took a holistic view of the matter, and we had a balanced policy. And that's what we're going to return to, where we work with communities through the Peace Management Initiative, through things like Unite for Change, where we try and ensure that in communities there are mechanisms to reduce tensions and the incentive or the capacity for reprisals. Reprisals are a major source of violence in the country. They need to be dealt with by proactively working with community influencers so that small disputes don't become major things that generate a spiral of murders. That's what the Peace Management Initiative had been doing quite successfully. It has been defunded and denuded by this government. Unite for Change, again, was working with the churches, working with NGOs and so on, to try and give so-called unattached youth at risk an opportunity to get into formal productive endeavors, whether it be ensuring that they have a TRN, that they have a birth certificate, that they're literate, that they have skills training, that they can, a way in which you can provide them with some soft financing to get into business, all of those things. Project STAR, which is the current private sector initiative, is really modeled on Unite for Change. It's very similar, but Unite for Change was a state-sponsored program and was much more of a national program. The challenge with Project STAR is because of its limited resources, it can only touch on a few communities at a given point in time. So that's an important part of our crime management philosophy. Apart from that, we need to ensure that the police have the necessary tools to do their job. This government strategy has been really focusing on the military, the buildup of the military, the JDF. They've doubled the number, the size of the JDF, and a significant capital expenditure for the JDF, really at the expense of the JCF, especially in the 2017, 2018, that period early on, when crime really got out of control. And, that has been, in the recent year, last couple of years, they've been trying to make up that lost ground by trying to increase the numbers in the police force. But you see, the problem is when you have crime has reached a certain level, to get it back down is very challenging. So, you know, we feel that ensuring that the police are properly looked after, the necessary legislative changes are made. This government is really underperforming when it comes to legislative solutions to problems. Legislation really doesn't cost money to implement and to develop. It just requires diligence and creative thinking. And this government is lacking in that. So, for example, CIMA, the Crime Monitoring and Oversight Committee, which is a bipartisan mechanism with civil society involvement, trying to take a long-term view of how we solve the problems that create crime. There were deliverables in the MOU that created CIMA. There were deliverables that the government has not delivered on. An Enhanced Security Measures Act still hasn't come. Unexplained wealth orders as a tool for tackling corruption still hasn't come. There's no excuse for that. If we had been in government, those would have been in place long ago. So, you know, these are some of the areas that the government has really dropped the ball in terms of giving the law enforcement the necessary tools. And, you know, I'm a former justice minister, and I see the importance of the integration of justice and security in order to achieve certain goals. So, for example, case preparation within the police force is vital, ensuring that the police understand and are equipped to prepare cases for trial so that the necessary elements of the offense can be proved successfully and the prosecution doesn't collapse. We need to empower the police, integrate them with the office of the DPP in that regard, in terms of a synergistic approach. It happens to some extent, but it needs to be deepened so that we have proper case preparation and case management coming out of the police force. So these are some of the tactics and strategies that we would employ and have worked in the past and need to be doubled up on, and so that we can get our murder rate down from being one of the worst in the world to one which is much more tolerable. And of course, if we can also achieve our objectives in terms of the education problem and the problem of training and get our youth off of a pathway of destruction and badness and into productive citizenship. And that's why we will have a Ministry of Social Transformation, focusing on how do we build a cohesive society, family values, you know, ensuring that single parent mothers and so on have the necessary support so that their children are nurtured and can get through primary school, you know, and achieve, you know, literacy by the time they reach the secondary school. If
I feel all like the crime is one of those issues that neither party has really been able to get right so far and make a major dent in, and it just continues to get worse and worse each year, regardless of initiatives that are put in. But I want to move on to
I agree with that to an extent, Khalila, but I think the data matters. And the fact of the matter is that we perform significantly better in this area than the current government. That 25% per annum lower murder rate translates to literally thousands of people who would be alive today had they not had been exposed to the higher murder rate under the current government.
Mm. Our next question comes from Oren, who wants to know, does your government plan to put in place any legislation or laws to prevent an SSL-like scenario from happening in the future? Which I think is a great question, because as you would know, the market has been destabilized since last year. The loss of investor confidence has resulted in dramatic losses on the stock exchange. And a lot of people who are watching this show right now are invested and are seeing those losses continue to pile up. We recently saw the JSC managing director say we should expect another 2 years of losses. So a lot of it stemming from SSL, that loss of investor confidence. So how do we bring back investor confidence? And like Oren asked, would you put in any legislation to prevent such a situation from happening again?
Yeah, that's a great question, Oren. The truth is that the demise of the stock exchange predated the SSL debacle, but the SSL debacle has compounded the problem. And in my view, it's a governance issue primarily. The FSC, I think, was not given the necessary strong independent board that was required to implement the regulatory regime which exists. We have a robust regulatory system in the country. The Financial Services Commission Act, the Securities Act, the Insurance Act, the Banking Services Act. These are all relatively modern pieces of legislation. They're not perfect, and there are always things that can be done to improve them. And one is constantly looking at how what that can be done. But the real problem with SSL was that the regulator essentially dropped the ball. They did not follow through with the necessary measures of enforcement which the law provided them. And why that was is still not clear to me. Why is it, for example, that the directions that they were had issued were essentially lifted when there was no basis for thinking that SSL had improved its performance? And, you know, some of the board appointments in the SSL, I don't want to get, the board appointments at the FSC, the regulator, I don't want to get into dropping names and all that. But they were very suspect because the persons who were there had no experience in the financial sector and didn't understand the way in which the risks that are inherent in the financial industry. That's an industry I'm very familiar with, Khalida. I have worked in that industry for my whole career. And as a lawyer, I was one of the architects of the FSC when the FSC was being developed as a concept. I worked with Brian Winter and others to do that and help to put in place that legislation, and it has worked well. If you look at it, we've had relatively few problems. We've had very few insolvencies and so on. We went through the 2007-8-9 international financial crisis without any crisis in our domestic market, and that's good. This SSL thing was a peculiar thing. For one, the company is known to have close links with the government. That is well known. The prime minister had his accounts there and pulled them shortly before the thing came. You know what hit the fan. The way in which the regulator was dealt with, the changes that were made at the board level, and then what happened after that in terms of the regulator essentially dropping its hand, that was also very problematic. I am hoping that this matter will be properly investigated. I'm very concerned that we're not getting regular reports from the powers that be that are investigating the crimes that took place there to keep the country abreast of what is happening. We heard the FBI were involved. We heard about some firm out of England from forensic auditors, you know, no doubt very expensive. What are they delivering on? I don't know. But we may have to have a commission of inquiry looking at the SSL thing. Oh. Because I feel that there's lessons, important lessons that need to be learned about what happened, which allowed that to take place. Because as you said, it has really undermined not just local investors, but Jamaicans abroad as well, who are seeing this and they feel, wow, how can this just happen? Where, you know, the track icon of the 21st century, Usain Bolt, has lost, you know, substantial savings that he put in there for his parents' pension. You know, it is a problem and it needs to be looked at. But I think the system and the laws are not the main problem there. It was the way in which the regulator operated. And the fact that this entity was allowed to go on for far too long without the necessary measures being put in place by the regulators, using the ladder of enforcement, which is in the law, to ensure that investors were protected.
So should heads have ruled at the FSC?
I think that there needs to be a serious look at that and as to what took place. I think that there have been changes. As you know, the Bank of Jamaica is essentially running the FSC now. The person in charge at FSC is a Bank of Jamaica operative now. So, you know, there have been changes, but it's too late. It's after the crisis that are already crystallized.
What would a commission of inquiry accomplish?
Well, we had a FinSAC commission of inquiry. Mm-hmm. Over $100 million was spent.
And they've never delivered. Although we can't get a report.
And we can't get a report out of it, which is a disgrace. Another disgrace.
Which is why I ask, what would a commission of inquiry accomplish?
I think that commissions of inquiry can be successful in looking in depth at the problem and at delivering a report with recommendations. For example, after the West Kingston incursion of 2010, you know, we undertook a commission of inquiry and we brought in a steam judge from Barbados to chair it and two other eminent persons, and they were able to complete their work and deliver a report which basically looked at the whole issue. Some of their recommendations have not yet been implemented, but some have. And, you know, I think that it's an example of how a commission of inquiry can function, can operate within its budget and deliver a report, which is a meaningful report. It's a question of management. I don't know what happened with the FinSAC one. I don't think that that was a mismanaged situation. It was botched by the then Minister of Finance. And it's a real scandal that the government could have spent over $100 million and have no report to show for it. So it's tragic because it was an important episode in the history of Jamaica. And there are a lot of strong views held as to why what happened and why. And it's important that we get to the truth because it's often the subject of all kinds of rhetoric and propaganda. And you know, I think what the truth needs to come out as to what were the causes, what were the measures, why did FinSAC come into existence and what did it do, and so on. So it's an important thing. But I don't think you can have something like SSL that just go by the wayside, no accountability, nobody's brought to book, nobody really knows what took place. The Minister of Finance received reports, they were in his cupboard, he didn't act on them. He's not been held accountable for that. You know, we need to get to the truth of it, and we need to have it done in a proper, transparent, and independent way. So I would be in favor of that, you know, when we are in office.
Wow. All right. So we're coming up upon time, but I do have to ask you this. There's been widespread speculations that there will be an election called this year. How confident are you, given that you're currently behind in the polls, not you personally, I mean the party's currently behind in the polls.
I don't know which poll you're referring to. We're ahead in the polls. Oh. We're 3% ahead in the polls.
Maybe I'm late with the numbers.
Sorry. Yeah. We've been ahead in the polls we drew level with the government February last year. And in June we were ahead, and in September we were ahead. And in the poll that some private businessmen procured, which was published in December, we're 3% ahead. So we're confident, actually, and my confidence continues to grow every time I go on the road and every time I see and hear from people in the street who are absolutely fed up with the corruption. They're fed up with a government that they think doesn't care for them. They're fed up of living in fear with no real crime plan for dealing with the situation. And yes, you know, the macroeconomy is fine and the credit rating agencies are happy. But that is not translating into meaningful benefits for the people. And that is a problem for the government. And I don't think they know how to solve it. So I'm actually quite confident that in the next election, the People's National Party will prevail.
Okay, now I see what I was looking at. I was looking at parish council internal.
Right.
But we're more concerned. Yeah. At this moment, for me, I'm looking at the national picture, since the buzz is about general elections possibly being called this year.
Yeah.
Well, all the best when the time comes, Mr. Golding. We'll see you on the campaign trail, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Thank you very much for having me, Kalila. And keep up the excellent work of educating people about business and finance. I think that, you know, I'm very impressed what you've been able to deliver in this, you know, developing this portal and this show on your own. I know a little bit about where you're coming from, and, you know, keep up the good work. I think that what you have developed is a unique product, and people, I think, are benefiting from it and enjoying it. So God bless you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for making the time to come. PMP and opposition leader Mark Golding. And at this point, we invite our viewers to take this week's poll question. What areas do you think the government should give the highest priority? I almost feel like I know what the answer will be. A, crime. B, poverty. C, education. D, wages. E, other. Leave a comment. What areas do you think the government should give the highest priority? Take our poll on the community section of YouTube or on Twitter. And you can also leave your comments in the chat. So last week, Money Mission members were able to ask me anything that they wanted. So here's a clip of what you missed inside the Money Mission community. We don't have that clip. All right, no problem. Well, reminding you to hit that like button. Up next, we've got your market recap, and the analysts are standing by.
The Taking Stock was brought to you by Bulwark Insurance Agency. Insurance made easy.
If you had 10 minutes with a billionaire, what advice would you ask? Billionaire Michael Leachin is coming back to Money Media for the next installment of Ask Mike, and you could be one of five people to get personal finance advice from him. Check out some of our previous mentees.
You have to do both, Roberto. You have to work on the business and in the business. borrowing to invest. Borrowing to invest. That has been pivotal to how I create, to how wealth is created.
The link is in the description. Let's get this money. Hey, moneymakers, join the KRM fam with our official merch. Get it now at KalilaReynolds.com. Let's get this money.
The JSE Combined Index was mostly flat last week. 122 stocks traded across the main and junior markets for the week ending Friday, January 12, 2024. 49 made gains, 56 lost value, and 17 stayed the same. 90 million shares changed hands on the Jamaican dollar market, valued at $669 million. Wigton was last week's most traded stock. It took up 32% of market volume, with 29 million shares trading. The stock gained 15 cents to open the new week at 88 cents. The stock was also the week's second biggest gainer, up 20%. Edufocal traded the second highest. The stock lost 13 cents to open this week at $1.47. And TransJamaican rounded out last week's most traded, with 4 million shares changing hands. The stock gained 12 cents to open Monday at $2.79. Now let's see who had the biggest gains for the week. AS Bryden was the market's biggest gainer. The stock was up 21% to open Monday at $40.40. And MFS Capital was the week's third biggest gainer after Wigton. It was up 15.5% to open the new week at $2.30. On the losing side now, AMG Paper and Packaging was the week's biggest loser. The stock lost 84 cents to open Monday at $2.41. Jetcon was the week's second biggest loser, opening the new week at 78 cents. And KLE Group lost 23% to close the week at $1.50. Over on the Trinidad and Tobago Stock Exchange, the composite index lost 10 points, about 1% last week. Massey was the most traded stock. The stock gained 1 cent open this week at $4.45 TT. National Flour Mills was the biggest gain of the week. The stock was up 5% to start the week at $1.99 TT. And on the losing side, National Enterprises fell 9% to open Monday at $3.59 TT. Over in the US, the Dow Jones was up 1% last week, while the S&P 500 was up 2% and the Nasdaq 3%. Motorists saw a slight increase over the pumps last week. Gas prices went up 25 cents, while regular diesel climbed $1.45 and low sulfur diesel gained $1.13. In foreign exchange, it took an average $156.28 Jamaican to purchase $1 last Friday. That's $1.15 more than the week before. Meanwhile, it took an average $118.08 Jamaican to purchase $1 Canadian. One British pound cost on average $199.46 Jamaican. And you could buy €1 for $172.46 Jamaican on average. Finally, on the crypto markets, Bitcoin prices were down 9% over the past 5 days, trading at $42,241 US on Monday. Ethereum prices dipped 3%, trading at $2,501 US on Monday.
Disclaimer. This is not intended as financial advice. Please consult a licensed financial advisor before making investment decisions.
Welcome back. It's time now for the analyst. We only have one analyst today, but first, let me take a few more of your comments. Actually, I'll leave the comments for the end of the show. So right now, we're going to be welcoming David Rose, business writer at the Jamaica Observer. Welcome back, David. And Happy New Year, because I think it's the first time I'm seeing you for the year.
You're correct, Kalila. Happy New Year to you and the rest of the viewers.
Awesome. Well, let's get straight into it. This evening, you are analyzing Honeybun's financial results, and this is for the year ended September 30.
You said 3 a while ago.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's usually I have 3 in my notes, but 30 make more sense. So how did they do?
You know, Honeybun had their best year ever. The company surpassed the $3 billion revenue mark for the first time, and they were able to actually grow revenue by 16%, you know, which was against the backdrop that they faced last year, which was higher prices for, you know, imports, higher fuel costs. and just inflation all around. So when you actually get to the gross profit margin area, and you actually take the gross profit margins, Honey Bun was able to increase its gross profit margin from 39.8% to 43.3%. Now, for a company to increase its gross profit margins by that much, even against the backdrop of higher sales, it speaks to the company able to actually translate, you know, the additional equipment that they have on board to actual volumes being sold on the shelves. So we saw that from Honey Bun, you know, and at the end of the day, they're able to grow the net profit by 12% to $232 million, which all bodes well for overall shareholders. And it's kind of interesting to think that back, I believe it was, May 2012, Honey Bun would have listed on the JSE as a much smaller business, earning a lot less in terms of profitability. And now they're contributing about over $50 million annually to the GOJ's coffers. So, you know, Honey Bun's story really speaks to the success of the junior market in giving these smaller companies the space to thrive under a more attractive regime in terms of benefits from the tax remission, alongside the requirement for governance to be in place to really thrive and become larger taxpayers later on. Because if you were to potentially go back right now and look at the amount remitted over the last 10 years and look at the last 2 years in terms of taxes paid, you know, it probably is pretty astounding. And even for Honey Bun, they actually grew their staff count by, 29% from 235 persons to 302 over the year. And that was also accompanied by a significant capital expenditure spend. What does that mean? They spent $167 million on new equipment for the business. So all of this is just showing that the company has taken its time to really sit down and ensure that it's focused on delivering its business mantra and also delivering returns to shareholders. So while you would have seen, you know, this improvement in earnings, you're not seeing that same translation in the stock price. So Honey Bun's stock price was down 18% last year. And even with the results that came out recently, you're not seeing that same level of reaction to the great results. And, you know, it's just against the backdrop of higher interest rates. We're hearing different senior leaders or senior persons in the space say the market's going to take a little bit more time to recover. So while Honey Bun, you know, alongside some other companies are showing great results, you're not seeing that similar pace of growth in the stock price. So if you actually look at the price to earnings ratio, which is a metric to compare amongst companies in the same sector against the market, Honey Bun is about 12.7 times, which is pretty low for a manufacturing company. And if you look at other companies like Wisinko or Jamaica Broilers, it's potentially even lower. So this is all to say that manufacturing companies are seeing some level of true growth, you know, between their export and domestic markets, but it's not being reflected effectively at the same pace in their stock price.
It's interesting because it's kind of the same situation with most companies on the market right now. Even the ones that are doing well internally, the stock prices is just not reflecting it. So it could be just a sign of the times right now, David, and that loss of investor confidence that we were speaking with Mr. Golding about a short while ago.
So there are two sides to that equation. While, you know, persons are and should, you know, have some level of concern with the developments that have happened over the last year, at the same time, if the companies themselves are performing appropriately and their auditors are doing their appropriate jobs in terms of reviewing the financial statements and preparing them, then there shouldn't be as much worry for some of these companies, especially when some of these companies are still in what you'd call a progressive expansion phase that is not just looking at the local market, but also on the international market. So for example, Wisinko, you know, wants to eventually get 10% of their sales to be exports. That's under 2% right now. You have Jamaica Broilers, you know, which is driving a good sum, in a sense, from the US market that they're operating right now. We're seeing where Separate is benefiting from their AS Bread acquisition in Trinidad. So it's going to take some time, you know, for investors to start putting some level of capital back into the market. But that is also where you're seeing potentially like at MJE, and with MJE in particular, you know, taking some of these larger positions, some of these Jamaican companies that are growing at astonishing paces. So if you've actually sat down to go through the audited financials of some of the unit trusts or even the quarterly publications, only a few companies actually do this with their unit trusts, you've seen that because of the decline in the stock prices, persons would have had equity-based unit trusts or mutual funds would have been in more withdrawals during the year to, you know, preserve value and to potentially deal with their own personal expenses. So that is also a potential factor in terms of what we're seeing in the market right now, whereby because the persons or the unit holders are seeking to redeem more units in the unit trust, the unit trust has to be selling more shares on the market to get that cash to pay out in your redemptions to the unit holders. So there is just a very, I should say, continuous cycle on different fronts, whereby because prices are going down, prices are requesting redemptions, and that this has a critical type of impact. But at the same time, Jamaican economy today is drastically different than the Jamaican economy a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
So while, you know, we would have seen the market had its significant height in 2019, we're having a larger market in terms of our massive, our Guardian Holdings, of AS Bradley, and we have, you know, several of a single. We have, who else can I just think of right now? But we have a lot more diversity in our market in a sense of newer companies with larger scope. And the reality is business is not going to stop with reduced investor confidence. Only difference is that for some persons, they're going to be able to collect significant gains by purchasing some securities at significant discounts, where that actually results in getting a higher yield on the dividend income in some instances. So I hope that makes some level of sense in how I'm explaining it.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about what Marlene Street Forrest said recently, that it's going to take another 2 years before we start seeing the market recovering?
I agree with her comment. You know, someone asked me last year, you know, earlier this year, what are my expectations for the market? And I just pointed out that based on the uncertainties that exist in the environment and the uncertainty that exists in persons timing the rate cuts, you're going to have persons be looking towards other investment opportunities that give them some level of stability and semblance. Because if you looked at the market last year, two-thirds of the securities are, or I should say two-thirds of the ordinary companies or ordinary shares were down last year, and most of them are down double digits. Some companies would have been reducing dividend payments to shareholders, which is a problem because if you're reducing dividends, it's just cash in your pocket. And you've had persons just say, why should I take in this level of risk in the market at the moment, when for me, my main focus is I need to be getting cash and I need some level of liquidity. And it's just a function of how the economic cycles work. And at the same time, the economic realities are different individuals, because if the JSC's bond market, for example, was of a larger scale, we probably might have been seeing potentially more fixed income trading in that space. Well, now, for sure, it is traded at the moment in that bond market, but you're still seeing not much trading in that perspective. But if you speak to the brokers, or you actually look at the Bank of Jamaica and GOJ issuances within the last couple of months, you're seeing some significant oversubscriptions by investors. So why would I take the risk of entering the equity market and facing that issue of being able to actually exit without a significant loss and potentially less dividend income or no dividend income, when I can actually go into the fixed income space and get 7.5% and above with less risk? In context, because for example, the BOJ's certificates of deposit, the 30-day, is giving 7.5% annualized. You can just keep rolling that amount over every month and be receiving, you know, a stable level of income that suits your needs and at the same time allows you to react if needed. So if you do see, for example, an opportunity to actually enter a particular security someone is willing to sell, then because you have the liquidity on hand, you're able to actually seize that opportunity rather than you actually said, all right, this stock looks great, looks like it's bottomed out, and you just see the price keep falling. And you know, you always hear about a falling knife. That's something that has happened, you know, to some persons in recent times where they said, stop bottom out, I'm going to jump in, and they just keep going down. And because they don't want to sometimes realize it's lost, they're just holding on to the security longer. So liquidity is the name of the game right now. And if you're a person with cash, you're a person who can actually bargain for discounts. So if you contact your broker, and most parents are aware of this, you can actually ask them to arrange a trade for you with, you know, another person of that security on your behalf. So instead of you going to the market and seeing nobody going to sell that particular price that you want or in sufficient volume, you can actually ask your broker, hey, I want to get 10,000 shares, let's just say $1, and your broker would go out, send that order out to different brokerage firms, and you just might get it.
Makes sense. Take advantage of the opportunities in the market now. There is opportunity.
Kanila, if you sit down and do what one would call an annualized calculation on some of the prior dividend payments, or even look at the prior runway that exists for so many securities, it's an entire different ballgame. So there are opportunities in the space, but at the same time, because there is, you know, level of uncertainty in terms of when rates are supposed to go down, and persons also having to be dealing with their own personal expenses increasing, it is a cat and a mouse game. Because I saw somebody earlier told me that, you know, their home insurance went up, you know, another financial institution increased the charter and peril insurance on, you know, homeowners, and, you know, you're just seeing all these other expenses come up out of nowhere. So having that liquidity in hand is good to take advantage of some of these opportunities once you're sufficiently able to allocate that capital. But at the same time, persons have to be very cognizant of, you know, what's really going on in the space. Because, for example, today, I remember seeing a security trade at $1.30. And the last time I saw the security trading that low was when COVID initially hit back in March 2020. This company had an IPO price of $1, and my business is down. They're a much bigger business today than they were a couple years ago. Doesn't mean a company is a great catch today, but at the same time, everything has taken in perspective of not just the current environment, but also the potential for the future. And deals exist locally and abroad, because in the US market, where there is sufficient liquidity in the space, in context, you're seeing securities just move pretty aggressively upwards in that space.
I only chuckled because I just saw a comment from Blue Maho Holdings, who you may, viewers, you would have heard about in What's Hot. Blue Maho says, that's how we got our KLE shares, taking advantage of opportunities in the market. And we're going to have Blue Maho Holdings on pretty soon, possibly next week, on the show to discuss, you know, their strategic moves and a lot going on with them. I know you did an interview with David Mullins recently as well. So two Davids joining forces. But thank you for joining me this evening, David. Appreciate your time as usual.
Thanks again, Kalila. And I'm looking forward to see you and everybody else, you know, another 2 weeks. And hopefully I'll make some moves with you this year in terms of other partnerships.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to take a quick break, our final break, and come back with your comments. And there are a lot of juicy ones. Be respectful.
Hi, my name is Ashantia Stewart. I am a business owner, the CEO of Ascendev, a digital marketing brand that assists business owners with growing online. Now, the money mission community that Kalila Reynolds have, I would recommend it to each and every business owner, because it is an environment in which you can meet like-minded entrepreneurs, in which if you have challenges in your business, you can go ahead and ask someone who has been there, who has done that. And with the launch of this event today, it was a true testament to how great the community is, because individuals showed up. You got to network, and you got to be in a place where in which it is not just you alone who has a mindset of growth. You had a place where in which individuals have been through the challenges. You have a place where in which you're getting insights into the industry. So I would recommend everyone to tap into it if you're an entrepreneur, if you're looking for growth, or if you're simply someone who wants to learn more. Thank you.
All right, let's take our comments. I'm chuckling in the comments. So Blue Maho saying that they plan to list on the NASDAQ. So interesting information. But you may have heard that before if you really follow the news. David saying maybe a listed vehicle in Jamaica can buy our stock after the listing and you get exposure, or you buy direct through your broker, because there are people asking if Blue Maho plans to list on the JSE, plans to list anywhere. But what he's saying is they plan to list internationally on the NASDAQ. Awesome. All right, let's take some more comments. These ones coming in regards to our interview with the opposition leader. Let me try pick some of them here, because a lot of them were questions. I was supposed to unstar these ones. I saw some warrior 777 said Portmore as an example of good housing is madness. I cannot speak to the quality of the housing, but the community itself, well, issues are well known with the community itself. Shellyanne said that he hasn't answered the question of what a commission of inquiry would accomplish. She says a report, millions of dollars for words on paper. Keisha saying the FinSAC report really should be finalized and published. So yes, we also learn from it. Less speculation, facts matter. Kofi says we need a ministry of commission of inquiry. A whole ministry just to do commissions of inquiry. Keisha again says that's it. Those regulatory oversight bodies must have independence and be properly structured and have properly structured boards to oversee. That is so true. Tanisha says heart training is not enough. We need to aim higher. Tech, finance, and engineering should be pushed more. These kids are already excited about tech. They just need the push. Sean saying everything he mentioned for his crime plan sounds like things that should have already been implemented. Sean again talking about Honeybun, saying they're considering dividends. Katie believes that the SSL debacle is the straw that will break the government's back, if you're blaming the government for what happened at SSL. That's debatable. Janet says, Mr. Mark Golding, I'm happy you're my leader and you will be Jamaica's next prime minister. You have a fan here, Mr. Golding. We have Roswell, who says JMMB needs to work on profitability, Sagicor's synergy in JMMB, as that will add up to their last quarter. D says we're also seeking higher returns in different investment instruments. Roswell again, financing and manufacturing basics in Jamaica's economy, more needed. Sean wants to know who are the investors that have access to government CDs and bonds. Ask your broker. You can invest in government treasury bills and you know all these things. Ask your broker about it. Usually the minimum is about $100,000. Sometimes it can be higher, depending on what is being offered, but ask. Sharon says, thank you. This was stimulating. Thank you, Sharon. And we have James saying, social intervention is a waste of money and time as it relates to crime and violence. Give a dollar figure. How much was spent on that? I don't know that social intervention is a complete waste, because, you know, it's hard to measure the people who would have committed crime who didn't, because they, you know, there was social intervention on their behalf. You can't subtract something that never happened. You don't know what would have happened if that intervention didn't take place. So it's a difficult thing to measure. I don't think it's completely pointless. But thank you so much for joining me, everyone. I appreciate your presence yet another week. Remember to like the video, hit that like button on YouTube. It helps the algorithm to push the show. Subscribe to the channel. And of course, share with a friend. And I also have to issue another warning, because the fraudsters and the scammers are out there big time. Every single day I get messages. Is this you? Is it you that's chatting with me on TikTok? No, it is not. And if you go on TikTok right now and you search my name, matter of fact, I could probably share my screen and show you. You go on TikTok right now and you search for Kalila Reynolds in the search bar, you are going to see probably close to 100 fake pages. And these are all scammers, people who are impersonating me, who are using my name, and it's not me. And they are messaging people, and people have lost money, which I know for a fact. People have been sending money to these scammers. I found it. So I'm going to share my screen just to show you this warning. It's a very important warning. Do not send money to anybody who is talking to you, especially on TikTok, claiming to be me. So this is TikTok. Typed in my name, Kalila Reynolds. This is my page, 150,900 followers. Look at all the impersonators. Okay. Look at that. Another one, another one, another one. Some of them use different pictures, various iterations of my name. And I've blocked most of these people, but they still find a way around it. Every time I report them, there's another one that pops up. The other day, I was out at a social function and this person came up to me and he said, you know, we've been talking on TikTok and I'm going to send you the money soon. And I'm like, which money? You sure you're talking to me? And he's like, yeah, we were just chatting just now. And he pulled up his phone and sure enough, the person was there. I was standing there watching, you know, and the person was there typing to him, communicating with him, pretending to be me. Happens all the time. I know somebody who sent these people $7,000. $7,000. And that gone, that dead. Because people are out here impersonating other good people, hardworking people. I took many years to build up my reputation. And they're using my name, and unfortunately, there's nothing that I can do about it. One person messaged me, Vex, saying that I stole their money. Despite all the warnings that I have posted and continued to post. But, I mean, it is what it is. Unfortunately, I can't do anything about it until at least TikTok decides to verify me, like I've been verified on all the platforms. But as of now, just be extra vigilant. It is scamming season. The scammers have gotten extremely bright, and not only are they impersonating people who you trust, they are using every measure in the book to con you out of your money. The phishing scams and the skimming scams and, you know, anything that you can, any way that they can get your money, they are going to use. And so I see all the complaints about money being taken out of people's accounts, and people blaming the banks and the systems and fraud and so on. But sometimes it's you who make the mistake and trust the wrong people and click the wrong link. And you have to be the sentinel of your money. You have to guard your money, watch your money like a hawk, and trust nobody. Trust nobody. Even if you feel like you trust me, I don't ask people for money. Even if you feel like it's somebody you know and trust, especially social media, don't do it. Do not do it. And I'm going to leave you on that note this evening, because 2024, if you think the scamming was bad last year, I feel like it turned up 2024. So be careful out there, guys, and have a great evening. That's it for tonight. See you next week.
This money.